Good evening. I'm Heather Brown, and this is Between the Covers. Tonight, the final episode from Terence Greene's novel, Shadow of Ashland. Leo Nolan has been to Ashland, Kentucky, in search of his uncle Jack, who's been missing for 50 years. And he did find him there, but to Leo's astonishment, Jack was still a young man in his 20s, as he was when he disappeared. Through some inexplicable force, Leo found himself back in 1934. He and Jack, along with several other men, worked on digging a tunnel under the streets of Ashland to rob a nearby bank. But the tunnel collapsed with Jack in it, and his body was never found. Now, Leo has returned to 1984 and to his home in Toronto.
In Toronto, life went on. I returned to my job, visited my father occasionally. He had been right, I guess. Things have to be settled or they never go away. At first, I phoned Jean weekly. Then it was twice a week. August became September. The nights became cooler. But I still tossed, slept restlessly, alone. By late September, we were talking every night. When the phone rang, I expected it to be Jean. It was my father. "Another letter came," he said. I had thought it had ended. I had thought it was over. From Ashland? From Jack? "From Jack, but not from Ashland. Come and see." I hung up and left. The yellowed envelope had the 2-cent Washington red and the green 1-cent counterpart. It was postmarked Bucyrus, Ohio, December 23, 1934. My father handed me the letter that had been inside. It was dated the same as the postmark on the envelope. "Dear Margaret, sorry I haven't written for so long, but I've been more than a little busy. Things didn't work out in Ashland. You have no idea how I wish they had. It's kind of complicated and a long story, but there was some trouble. Nothing that you should worry about. And I figured it was time to go. Bucyrus is pretty. Odd jobs are scarce, but so far I can make enough for food, a place to stay, and a pack of cigarettes. What more could a fellow want? How I got here, now there's a story, but I'll save it for another time. Your little brother has managed to get out of a tight scrape and land on his feet. I guess I'm learning to survive. You know, Marg, I'm beginning to miss Toronto. There's lots of times when I sit here in my room and think back to Berkeley Street. It wasn't so bad, you know. Actually, it's the fact that Christmas is only 2 days away that's got to me. I miss everyone dearly and feel kind of alone right now. I wish I could see you again, but it isn't in the cards right now. Remember how we used to string the popcorn with Mother, while Father would sit and smile and smoke his cigar? Gee, I must be getting sentimental. That was a long time ago. I'm sending along a little something for everyone for Christmas. Buy something nice for yourself and for the kids. And I'd like to ask a favor. Could you send the enclosed to Teresa Matuzik, care of the Scott Hotel, Ashland, Kentucky? I don't want to send it myself because too many questions might be asked. So if you can keep it for a while till you get to Portover next summer and mail it from there. That way it wouldn't have a Toronto postmark on it, and that's important to me. The whole thing is kind of private, if you know what I mean. Speaking of Ashland, I met a friend of yours there. His name's Leo. Nice fella. Say hello to him for me. Lots of love. Jack. My father handed me 2 faded postal money orders for 20 American dollars each. I looked at them. One was made out to my mother. The other was made out to Teresa Matuzik. Squeezed out of the earth, I thought. The mud, the water, the tunnels. Jack was still out there, somewhere, moving across America. My father was good enough not to phone me at work until near the end of the day. Otherwise, I'd never have been able to get anything done. But at 4 o'clock, the call came. "Another one, Leo." I didn't ask anything. "I'll be by on my way home." It was from Toledo, the same address as before, 117 17th Street. It was dated April 30th, 1935. "Dear Margaret, this one's just a short note to keep in touch. I went out with a friend for a drink today because it was my birthday. I'm 24 today, Marg. So how come I feel like I'm about 50 years older? I guess too many things have happened, and I seem to have lost so much. I went to Mass on Sunday, been missing it too much. Next thing you know, I'll have to go to confession. Don't know where I'll start my list of sins, The priest better cancel whatever he has planned for the rest of the day, that's for sure. I'm keeping busy. Not much work here, though. I miss everybody. Lots of love. Jack. It took a week for the next one to arrive. It was, as I was beginning to suspect it might be, from the Vermont Hotel, Detroit. Jack was coming north. He was coming home. It was dated August 21st, 1935. Dear Margaret, happy birthday. I realize this won't get to you until after your birthday, but better late than never, right? Sorry to have been out of touch for so long. Gee, I always seem to be apologizing for not coming up to snuff. I guess I'll never change. I remember telling you how much I loved being here the last time I wrote, and how it would break my heart to have to go back to Toronto. How times change, eh? Even Hardican's gone out of business. Everybody seems to be in trouble, so I guess you could say I'm in good company. I miss Toronto more and more. Don't be surprised if I show up on your doorstep sometime real soon. By the way, I hope you sent that money order to Teresa, maybe from Port Dover this summer. I miss her, too. But it wasn't going to work. Sometimes I feel real bad about it all and how it ended, but that's another story. I like to visit the shrine here at Royal Oak. When I get to Toronto, I'll bring you a rose from the garden there. Take care, Marg, and say hello to everybody. Hope I see you soon. Lots of love, your brother, Jack. I placed the letter on the kitchen table. My father was sitting at the other end. Things have to be settled, he said. I looked at him. I felt shaky. I had to sit down. Or they never go away, I finished, my voice a whisper. Then I closed my eyes and saw my mother's hand open on the hospital bed, saw her fingers unfold, saw the fresh red rose fall out, and heard her voice, an echo, thinly, again, always. Jack was here. Jack, I thought. Jack. He had come home, however briefly, as my mother had said. I put my hand to my forehead. Finally, squeezing my eyes tighter, I saw, with perfect clarity, Jack at Margaret's bedside, holding her hands, touching her face, smiling, seeing past the body that was dying, staring into the enduring heart of what she had once been, that single moment when our rose is in its full, vibrant bloom. Canadian Thanksgiving, I explained to Jean over the phone, was celebrated earlier than the American one. In 1984, it fell on Monday, October 8th. There was no direct air passage from Toronto to Ashland. I booked a flight on U.S. Air from Toronto to Huntington, West Virginia, Friday, October 5th. When I landed, I made two phone calls. One was to the Scott Hotel, the other was to Jean. I asked her if she could keep Saturday clear for the whole day for something special. The phone line crackled with anticipation at both ends. Then I drove my rented car the 15 miles or so along the Ohio to Ashland. It was still light when I pulled up in front of the Scott Hotel. Emma sat beside me on the wine-colored sofa with the needle-point pillows at each end. I've got some things I think you should have. I handed her Jack's letters, all of them. Detroit, Toledo, Bucyrus, Ashland, and back again. She held them in her hands, stared at them, set them down in her lap. One of them's got something in it for your mother, I pictured the money order, but I think you should have it. She looked at me. Thank you. It seemed best. It seemed like what Jack would have wanted if he'd known. Her hands tightened on the letters. Will I see you again? I think so. I've got friends here, she smiled. Family, too. I touched her arm. The place gets into your blood. Jean and Adam were waiting for me on the veranda when I pulled up in front of the house. I shook hands with Adam, then put my arms around Jean and held her. She was wearing the subtle southern scent from the evening of the chimney corner tea room, and nothing that I could remember had ever smelled so good. Got a trip planned for tomorrow, I said. I took a swig of beer from the long-neck bottle of Bud and digested the look on Adam's face. We were back outside, sitting on the steps beneath a warm October sky. Where? He asked. Gotta get up early. Take us half the day to get there. We'll stay over in a motel tomorrow night. Come home Sunday. My flight doesn't leave till Monday. Cincinnati? Baseball? Nope, not this time. It was Jean's turn to become curious. She had thought she had guessed it, too. She balanced her beer bottle with a hand on her knee. Where? She asked. We'll have a picnic while we're there. We'll make sandwiches tonight. Adam drank his Coke, his eyes jumping from one to the other of us. Jean smiled, watching Adam, her happiness evident. Ever been in a cave? I asked Adam. There was genuine surprise on his face. The expression on Jean's face wasn't far behind. No, he said. I looked at Jean. Can't say that I have, she said with wry amusement. Her eyes held mine warmly. Guess you could say they become a bit of an interest of mine. Kentucky's shot through with some of the best anywhere. Over 3,000 of them. Crystal Onyx Cave, Diamond Caverns. You even got Carter Caves about 30 miles west of here. Is that where we're going? Adam was smiling now, catching on. Nope, I said. It's a surprise. Man flies down from Canada, takes us on a mystery tour, said Jean. Wear walking shoes, bring a coat. I looked at Jean, at Adam. Smiled back at both of them. Glad I was here. We left at dawn and took 64 to Lexington, stopped and ate breakfast at a restaurant in the city, then got onto the Bluegrass Parkway to Elizabethtown. From there, we went south on 65. Where are we going? Asked Jean finally. Are you going to tell us? Trust me, I said. Adam giggled in the back seat. Shortly before noon, we reached Mammoth Cave National Park, the longest cave system ever discovered on Earth. I've been reading about it, I told them as we pulled into the vast parking area. Buses from around the country were massed at various locations amid the sea of cars. There's 294 miles charted on five levels. I stopped the car. You got that lunch, partner? Adam banged his fist on the cooler on the seat beside him. Then he looked out at the picnic areas. I'm hungry. Me too, he said. I looked at Jean. She laughed. All cave tours are walking trips. There's seven to choose from half a mile to 5 miles, from 1.5 hours to half a day. Jesus, Jean swallowed the bite of her ham on rye before continuing. You're not going to make us walk 5 miles, are you? No, I chuckled. Sounds a bit much even for someone as incredibly fit as I am. Adam giggled. Medium tour. Don't want the kid to strain himself. He poked me in the ribs, still giggling. Cave temperature was always 54 degrees, we were told. Most in the group of more than 100 put on coats. Then we strolled through the entranceway, disappeared beneath the earth. We went through huge rooms, winding passageways, saw towering formations, delicate onyx flowers, waterfalls, streams, pools. We went down ramps, up stairways, entered soaring caverns, inspected milky stalactites, stalagmites, flowstone, limestone pendants, sparkling geological snowdrifts, rainbow coral, ever downward. At the bottom, we entered the Mammoth Cave, the biggest, the best known. It took my breath away. Peering upward, I could not see its roof. Darkness in every direction, in spite of the lighting system. It was an opening in the earth that staggered the imagination, a space left behind millions of years ago by some dark, vanished sea, dwarfing us all. I felt humbled, lost. I tried to imagine the first ancient discoverers of the cave, the fear, the awe. The voice of the tour guide brought me back. I'm going to turn the lights off, she said, just for 1 minute. Don't move and don't speak. We want you to experience absolute darkness, just to see what it's like. You won't be able to see your hand in front of your face. There was some nervous laughter. Ready? Jean stood on my left, Adam on my right. I placed my hand on her shoulder, left my right hand dangling. The lights went out, and we stood there in total darkness. The seconds stretched out. Time stopped. I could hear my heart hammering loudly in my blood. I thought of my mother. I thought of Jack. I thought of my grandmother, of my brothers and sisters, of my own father, his hair impossibly white, sitting at the green arborite kitchen table with his hand in his belt, of the ancient money order made out to my mother that I would carry in my wallet from now on. I thought of Ashland, where dreams die and are born again. In the darkness. There were decisions to make. I had my life to live. Toronto. Ashland. Toronto. Ashland. Jean. Adam. Then, in the lightless space of that vanished sea below the earth, faced with the same terror and beauty, hope and loss, as those first ancient explorers, I felt small fingers slide into my right hand, seeking comfort from the void. My life to live. The lights came on. My hand tightened on his, and he smiled up at me, his eyes dancing with wonder. Through new tunnels of dark beauty, the light filtering through prisms of mist, wary of precipices and footing, we began the ascent up out of the earth and rock, to new places that we could only know by arriving in them, feeling the warm wind trickling down from the surface ahead of us, just ahead of us.
Michael Hogan, reading the final episode of Shadow of Ashland by Terence Green. This reading was produced by Dagmar Kafunka-Nunn, and the novel is published by Forge Books of New York and distributed in Canada by H.B. Fenn and Company. Terence Green has written a sequel to Shadow of Ashland. It's called St. Patrick's Bed, and this paperback is also published by Forge. Next week on Between the Covers, two stories about the nature of desire from Timothy Taylor's most recent book, Silent Cruise. Our poetry nightcap is partly about the satisfactions of gardening, but it's also about looking toward the future and good things to come. Clear to Me Now was written by Marlene Cookshaw, a poet who lives on Pender Island, B.C. It's read by Julie Stewart.
Clear to Me Now. What I planted this morning was not cabbages, but faith in the future. Little tag end to I know not what. In that, the exhilaration, giddy as license to desire. I've put my hand in next year. Thrown my lot in with Earth's. Harrowed, sweated, given over and stood back. Counted. Enough kale for us, the neighbors, ducks. Come spring, more yellow promises, bunched blossoms. See where the mind goes? Between the lovely knots, a silk always strong enough to bear its weight. That throwing's what I love, what I would give my life to. Lacinato. Champion. Rougette. Red cabbages, dense and beautiful as turbans. Roses. Words, like a row of toothy kisses, sweet, unmanageable, raw.
Clear to Me Now, a poem written by Marlene Cookshaw and read by Julie Stewart. It's from Shameless, published by Brick Books. And that's our program for this week. The coordinating producers for Between the Covers are Ann Jensen and myself, Heather Brown. Dagmar Kafunka-Nunn is the associate producer and Chris Cutress the engineer. Barb Carey is our poetry editor. Next up is the CBC Radio 1 News, and that's followed by Northern Lights from CBC Winnipeg. Good night and have a pleasant weekend.